Hang in there, it is.
Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. I'm Charlie Hume. He is Smiley Kaufman live from Vedanta World.
Yes.
In a nice little well-appointed hotel room overlooking the famous stream that always saw all the players taking little ferries to. Ferries the correct word? Got the gondola out there.
It was a nice boat that they transported us on throughout the week. Yeah, I mean, really cool place, man. I gotta say,
the little ferry interviews, that's a nice touch. Like, I wish we had more of that. Like,
on
anything.
The pontoon.
just enough of the song and not too much to get like a copyright infringement. So that's perfect.
Yeah, there you go.
Love that. I mean, what a wild week in Mexico. I think that, you know, that one was, you could suffer the criticism that some would make of a leaderboard that was, you know, not heavy on notable names. But I mean, I think to see Brian Campbell win this tournament to play off with Aldrich Potgieter, and really just look at the top three on that board with Isaiah Solinda finishing third. You know, we've talked a lot about the past. We can unpack it later in the show just about, you know, what the different identity of different tour events is and different tours are. And this, to me, I think is super, super cool from the fact that this is, and I think Dan Rappaport said this on Twitter, like, this is literally life-changing stuff for Brian Campbell.
Oh, dude, that's an understatement. Like, understatement of the year. Listen, man, that was the most bizarre Sunday of, I would call it pretty mediocre golf. It was nothing. It was not just these epic golf shots that we kept on hearing, or at least in my ear. I'm not watching it like you guys are. It just felt like nobody wanted to win this tournament. And that was the vibe, kind of the entire back nine. The front nine had an interesting start, because I was with the second to last group with Aaron Ryan. He was 500 through six holes. He started the day six shots back, and all of a sudden he's tied for the lead because Jaeger, Potgieter, and Campbell all were over par through five holes. And so I really felt like it was going to be a great finish with, and it turned out to be, right, with Campbell, Potgieter, and some other guys like Solinda, like you mentioned, with some opportunities. So just overall takeaways from the golf course, though, Charlie, was that this place is freaking long, man. I mean, just wearing out. Four irons, three irons, hybrids. I'm telling you, I don't think I had one guy hit a wedge into a par four. The 15th hole you would hit a wedge, but other than that, man, you're hitting in these par fives that you can't get there in two. You have these par fours, you're hitting four irons. There was a time today where I saw Ben Griffin hit a 3-wood into 10. Aaron Rye hit four hybrids in his first 10 holes. It's like, it's just crazy. I think it's probably the longest playing golf course on the PGA Tour.
Well, and it's so wild that we ended up with this to me was the battle of the head covers. We have Aldrich Potgieter, who's got one head cover, and Brian Campbell, who's got three, and the last one is that famous 7-wood, and it came in handy again a number of times today to keep him in contention and ultimately win in the golf tournament. But you had a guy that was one of the shorter players in the field against a guy who's you know, effectively the longest on tour now, and yet both of them can make it, you know, to this playoff via and Aldrich. It's interesting. Aldrich is known as his bomber, but really it was his putting that saved him a number of times this week and kind of got him near the top of the leaderboard. And then, you know, Brian Campbell was, I think, at one time leading in strokes gained approach, and I think finished third for the week. So, you know, it's kind of to your point. You either got to hit the thing a long, long way and make it a lot easier to hit approach shots in where you can score, or you better be dang good with those long irons or you know, 7-woods. And that's what Brian Campbell did, and that was his formula to win this tournament.
Dude, that's insane to me that Brian Campbell could possibly lead an approach from where he was hitting his drivers. Now, he was hitting a lot of fairways, give him that. So he is playing off of perfect lies. These past palm fairways are literally the best things I've ever walked on in my entire life.
Better than Zoysia?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a huge breaking news air horns.
I do feel like next year for this Mexican Open that it'd be sick if everybody didn't wear shoes and just went barefooted and played. Because that's like anytime you can get barefoot on this grass, oh, it's amazing.
That's what the tour needs. Like, we need a hickory tournament. We need a barefoot tournament. We need a one club tournament. This is like, if we're going to go ahead and reunify the PGA Tour and live, let's just throw a few like clauses in here to get some fun stuff on the schedule.
Yeah. Well, I'm sitting here looking. All right. So he ended up, Brian Campbell ended up fourth in the approach to the green category. But he was first in tee to green, man. That's just insane to me.
Insane.
Considering how long this golf course played and how short he is off the tee, he was 73rd, a 293. When you run all the formulas for this golf course and who fits it, dude, yeah, this is the guy you pick at Hilton Head. This is the guy you pick at Colonial, Sony. I mean, I can't tell you how badly I wouldn't recommend a player like this at this golf course. So you have to give him so much credit.
Huge.
So much credit for how well he hit his long irons, his fairway medals, and then how well he drove the ball to get it in the fairway. So, and just so I kind of personalize him just a little bit, coming off of, let's see, this was the PGA Tour. He was on tour, I think it was 16 and 17.
Yes.
Lost his card, went back to the Corn Ferry Tour for like 2 or 3 years, loses his card again, goes through Q school, gets his Corn Ferry Tour card back, and eventually gets his way onto the PGA Tour without winning on the Corn Ferry Tour. So, you know, had lost in a playoff last year, had a couple top fives. So obviously like a solid player on the Corn Ferry Tour. But all of that, just like, how can we encompass those years and just put it into words? To keep playing, you know, to keep the belief and to keep going at it every single day and keep just the struggle knowing that, hey, you're not providing for your family like you'd like to. You have all these doubts about where the game of golf as far as the modern player, and you got to hit it long to be able to compete on the PGA Tour. And, you know, Brian makes it out onto the PGA Tour in the top 30 without winning, and then has, you know, everything kind of feel like it was going against him. And then you get the break of the year, the ball that I saw from my own eyes was probably about a good, if I measured it from the edge of the out of bounds stakes, I would say it was a 10 yards out of bounds, and just the most insane bounce. Like, he had somebody watching over him throwing that ball back into the rough to where he could have a chance, because it was over. That golf tournament was over and completely flipped.
We're often on the golf course and use the phrase trees are 90% air. And thankfully, Brian found the 10% of that tree that was not air to get that kick. I mean, it was, and even still, I think Aldridge Pocketer, we'd watched him bomb the ball all week, all day long, but had that right miss a couple times on 18 when he played it in regulation and then the playoff hole. But this third drive lands right in the middle of the fairway, and you think still he's got a strong advantage. Leaves his approach shot in that front bunker. Campbell sticks a wedge tight for a birdie putt there, and Aldrich ends up hitting his third behind the hole and misses a downhiller, and that's the tournament. You know, Brian Campbell knocks in a short one for birdie, and he wins his first tour event. I'm wondering, Smiley, I mean, this obviously isn't one that's going to have an insane TV rating attached to it, right? And even just the more mainstream golf fan might sort of poo-poo this outcome and this field. But for the golf sickos out there, I feel like there's really something to take here of, you know, especially if you're looking at the part of your life where you're about to lose some distance and how you're going to play golf well, you know, again, the rest of your life. And then you see a guy like this go out and win the tournament in the fashion that he did. I mean, no one played convincing golf on a Sunday, but I mean, do you feel like this represents in some way, shape, or form the type of story that might be going away on the PGA Tour as we shrink fields, as we, you know, go away from Monday qualifiers, and maybe even specific to Brian? This is a guy that you would have likely said he will not finish inside top 100 and retain his card this next year. And now he's got a 2-year exemption on the PGA Tour.
Well, I guess just to answer your question, are these types of stories going to go away? I think it's a bit of a difference in what I think we were accustomed to as far as what the David versus Goliath type of TV that I think a lot of people really enjoyed with the PGA Tour. You got to, whether it's going up against Tiger, trying to take down a Titan and Tiger or Ernie or VJ with a journeyman player. That's not what this week was. This was a week where 90% of the field doesn't have exempt status in 2026. Only 10%, we're talking about 12 dudes, have a card for next year. So this field this week was all about, can anybody change their lives this week? And there was only a few players that I think you could have said, yes, this is for sure. Like a, maybe you could say like a David versus Goliath, but I don't think there's enough wins by, you know, guys in their peak or the prime of their careers that you could say that this field or this type of tournament going away. This event was more about who could take advantage of a field that was definitely lacking.
Yeah, and then on the other side of this win, of course, Aldrich Potgieter, who we know has all the talent in the world. We've talked about him a number of different times on the show. Had James Nitti's on. We kind of tipped him as a guy that could play really well this year, maybe win. Of course, you know, started Pothead Nation, which, you know, we are very crestfallen this week. The Rye guys and the Potheads, tough week to be in either one of those camps, especially hard if you're in both camps. But, you know, this is a guy who we talked about after the Farmers Insurance Open and the parts of the games he needed to improve on. You talked a little bit about his approach wedges. You know, obviously there's still some short game work to do there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe what – coming away from this week, what impressed you about Aldrich and the way in which his game continues to mature and develop, and what still remains there in terms of things he needs to work on?
Well, I'll start with the positives. Obviously, the driving. It's phenomenal. I think his putting show was really impressive, how many putts he made outside of 10 feet. I think his... an underrated thing, being a 20-year-old, not having, I would say, experience closing out PGA Tour events. I thought he was very composed for the most part, showed a lot of grit when he needed to have it. When you have the lead for, at least when you sleep on it a couple different nights, that's all you're thinking about. And so when he had to make some big saving putts like he did at the 8th hole, like he did at the 10th hole, that showed me that he's got the character to, you know, step up in big moments. The weak parts, let's talk about that. I think a lot of people that watch the coverage, I didn't get to see it as much. I just listened to it. It seemed like he was indecisive when it came to his short game shots around the greens, which this is what you get sometimes at elevated green surfaces where you have the option to fly it on the green or bump and run it. But it doesn't appear to me that he has this wide array of shots. When you grow up where he did in South Africa and in firm conditions, I'm sure that the shot that he's most comfortable with are bump and run type of shots. And when you have the technique that he does with the full swing, which is like a super, super strong grip, that isn't a great translator for pitching. You would like to be more on the neutral to the weaker side, if anything. So I think that's what he probably needs to continue to improve on, is just having more shots around the green at his disposal that he can cue up on a Sunday. It seemed like today that he just wasn't quite sure what shot to play, and it led him to some bogeys. But I also would probably say at times listening with where he ended up in some spots, that maybe there was a bit of decision-making just into the greens on where he played shots, as far as just being too aggressive at times or being too conservative others. But other than that, man, I was just so impressed by what he did, shooting a 61 on Friday. But getting to like briefly talk with him right after the tournament, I had a chance to interview him for our show. And while we're sitting there in the winners getting interviewed, you know, it's just like gut wrenching, right? Like you're just sitting there, you're just trying to make conversation. And he looked up and said to me, he was like, "Hey, I think I'm just going to be thinking about this the next 3 days, just how it's going to be really hard on him over the next couple of days." But I thought he had a really thoughtful answer, just talking about, it's easy for him now when he's going to go to bed tonight and watch Brian Campbell's ball in his head heading out of bounds, and somehow it comes back in, he makes birdie. I think if he's able to eventually get past that here in the next 48 hours, he'll remember all the good that he did do this week and the feelings that he had while he was in contention. And hopefully he's going to be able to use them the next time he gets there. And that's what I told him. I was like, hey, man, you're going to win on this PGA Tour. You just got to stay patient and just continue to believe in yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting because he doesn't strike me as the type of young person who lacks maturity or composure. I mean, your interview with him and other interviews that we saw throughout the weekend really kind of in anecdotes you hear from people talk about how he's this really polite, respectful, young guy who really has a good head on his shoulders, which isn't always the case for kids who come up and have all the talent in the world and could easily let that get out of control. So, I think it's a lot of the stuff you note is very interesting. I think back to just tracking his progress as we, knew he was going to graduate from the Corn Ferry Tour and come play on the PGA Tour. And he was in the pole position to win the 2024 Ned Bank Golf Challenge and shoots a final round 75 to kind of, lose that tournament there. And wondering if, is this a clutch gene sort of situation, which I don't think it is. I think it's, a guy of that age who, he's talked about the decision to forego college. And why would he do that? Because he's trying to prepare himself to become a professional. And so the way to prepare yourself to become a professional is to get these professional reps. And so if part of that process is, crushing blows, like losing a tournament where you feel like you're in the driver's seat, in a playoff the way he did this weekend, that's all going to be additional experience that grows him into the player that he wants to become. And he's doing that on a professional circuit instead of at a collegiate level where maybe the competition isn't as stiff. So, I think, that piece of it was interesting. I think you talk about some of the decision making. We were led in on a couple of caddy conversations today where there was a lot of interesting analysis on the broadcast where, really he's talking through shots with his caddy, but his caddy's really pushing it back on him to take ownership of these shots. And that, I wonder if you caught any of that or just a commentary on, as a caddy working with a young player, the straddling the line between helping them make a decision, helping them choose what you think is the correct club, and letting them gain experience and get to the right decision, even if it maybe adversely impacts them in the moment in that tournament.
Yeah, that's a great point you make there, because it's definitely a balance as a caddy that you have to be able to kind of tote the line back and forth on, because it is up to the player. They need to see the shot. And sometimes a player won't take ownership looking back on things. And sometimes they just want to be told where to go and what to do. And times they feel uncomfortable. And sometimes that eventually will just lead to blame the caddy and not taking full ownership yourself. So I think to that point you're talking about, it is important for Aldridge to make his own decisions. But also, you got to know what time and score is, and you got to know where a good par is, where a good birdie is, and sometimes where you just need to make your bogey, right? And understanding just the situation and where you're at. And so I think at times today, there was from just listening, right? I'm not watching the coverage like everyone else, that when if he ever was indecisive, it's like, hey man, let's just take a 10 footer here. Like, let's not try to be the hero and play a flop shot. Let's give ourselves a 10 footer, or when we're hitting into the green with not a great angle, like, let's not go right at this. Let's be specific on where we're aiming. So that would be the takeaway as far as just the player caddy deal.
And I mean, I think this week was cool for a lot of other reasons. In addition to a guy like Aldridge, who obviously is incredibly young, we had Blades Brown at 17 years old make the cut. I mean, no better time to look at just the future of what this tour can be than right now, to see Blades and Luke Clanton and all this slew of young talent that is ready to kind of make this huge impact on the world of golf. I saw some quotes from Blades that I found super interesting in the context of something you've talked about on the show before. So he's talking about, trying to make the cut. And he said, I was trying to make many, many matches to myself, saying, okay, let's try to shoot 2 under par in the last two holes. I was kind of watching the cut line just to kind of see what it was going to be. And I knew that it was going to be anywhere around 3 or 4. And I was happy to get in with 5. And so that's a very surface level explanation of something you've talked about on the show before. And it was actually a game that I think you took from Tiger Woods, hearing something Tiger Woods said. And I think just for people who maybe didn't catch that episode, whenever it was last year, just talking about, I mean, I want to hear your thoughts, of course, on Blades and the way he plays. I think you have some good information there, but just the game playing, you know, because I think that's another piece of maturity for young players of shooting out, figuring out how to shoot the score you need to make a cut or to get to a certain position on a leaderboard or to win a tournament. Just the types of things you did, reflecting on what Blades is talking about there.
Yeah, I think that system was any player can use it. It's if you three putt, it's a point. It's a bogey with the wedge is a point. A bogey on a par five is a point. These are obviously negative points, but you add them up as points. An easy up and down that you're supposed to, you know, be able to take care of. That one that you would say, "Oh gosh, I should have gotten that one up and down." And double bogeys, that would be a point, and obviously triple would be 2 points. So yeah. Adding those up, anytime I was four or less, I always top 10 on the PGA Tour. And that was apparently what Tiger's goal was too. So that's a good way to do it. And also, I mean, I think for a guy 17 years old, first off, I got a chance to spend some time with Blades this week. And what a great young kid. He's got an incredible personality, just so so confident in himself, but in a great way. Like, he's just kind of this bubbly 17-year-old kid who's confident and just like happy to be on the PGA Tour. It was kind of a breath of fresh air, just spending a little time around him. My first time really just even meeting him was on 17 on Wednesday. And he's like, "Hey, come here. I'm about to hit this like sick little flop shot. Got these awesome pass foul and rough. Watch this." And he just goes whoosh, and just hits this like spinny chip shot. I was like, man, I don't know if any like 17-year-old kid would just go up to like an announcer, not saying I'm like some big deal or anything, but a guy he doesn't even know, and just say, "Hey, watch this." So like immediately was a fan of the kid walking the way. I was from afar, obviously, have wanted to see him do well. But now I'm like, okay, I'm Team Blades Brown. He makes the cut. And I'm like, okay, let's get this guy on the happy hour. Let's talk about it at 17 on Friday. And then like right before we were about to go like 20, 30 minutes out, get a note from our team that said, "Hey, because he's 17 years old and Michelob's a sponsor, we got to nix it." So, and I was like,
"That's
hey,
amazing.
I don't ID here at the desk. I mean, I think fake IDs would be totally fine at the desk." So that was obviously a bummer not to get to talk to him, because I think everybody would have really gotten a chance to see the lighter side of this kid.
Joining us now in happy hour, McLovin.
McLovin, there you go. But his just like doing some like research on him too. I didn't realize he was the medalist at the U.S. Junior, the medalist at the USAM. Two only other golfers had done that to this point were Bobby Clampett and Tiger Woods. So like he's in elite company with being able to say he's, you know, in company with those two guys. So and just hearing about the decision too of him turning pro and why, I think that was interesting. Obviously, I'm sure there was money involved, and I can't give you any numbers of saying, "Hey, this was the NIL offer he had at X college," or "this is what this club manufacturer paid him." I can't give you those numbers because I don't know them. But the idea was seeing that Akshay Bhatia, first off, same agent. So seeing that he kind of laid the path of like, all right, a good, talented young player that doesn't want to be in college more than a year or two. What are the benefits of turning pro? And I think for him, it's probably that, hey, if I can play my way into that special temporary status, and which gives you the unlimited amount of sponsors invites. So that's obviously goal number one. But the other thing too is the top 200 as far as the points list goes. So he can't accumulate points as an amateur, so it's silly for him to go play events. So now that he is a pro, like for instance this week, like he'll accumulate points. They're not official PGA Tour points because he's not a PGA Tour member. But let's say he accumulates enough to break whatever the top 200 threshold would be. Now he's got an opportunity to get Korn Ferry Tour status. So his thinking was, all right, I can, you know, get some starts on the PGA Tour, get some starts on the Korn Ferry Tour. But really, I mean, this year is an opportunity for him to make some cuts, get some points, and then hopefully be able to get Korn Ferry Tour status versus having no status. Although you know, you could play well as an amateur and you think you're there. Like, for instance, Luke Kwan, now it's probably a terrible example because he's actually, you know, finished really high, but just an opportunity to get some good status.
Well, it's just so interesting to see the different paths that each of these young talented players choose to take. And now there are two we're talking about on the show in Blaze Brown and Aldrich Potgieter.
That same are coach, at, by the way.
And looking at different paths, you know, Aldrich at 20, Blaze at 17. They're looking at Akshay at 23, you know, who's, you know, one of the best players in the world now, top 50 guy in the world, maybe even higher than that, you know, and just saying, what's going to benefit me the most here? Is it going to be, you know, playing against other professionals and gaining professional experience? Now, the gamble you take is the one you just outlined as to, you know, how are you earning status? How are you getting exemptions into tournaments? What does that convert to at the end of the season? If you don't win an event or top 10 a bunch, you know, what does the rest of your journey look like? But it is interesting to hear you talk about what Blaze was thinking about going through that. And clearly there's been some sort of calculation done by his team as to the way it's going to play out and what your best case and worst case scenarios are. And if they feel good about playing a year and getting Korn Ferry Tour status and playing your way back in that way, then that's the, and I completely understand it. You know, it actually had a banner year, you know, that last year on the Korn Ferry Tour, won several times and makes his way up to the PGA Tour, and the rest is sort of history. So it's an interesting path that each guy going about it differently. You know, to your point, Luke Clanton goes, plays collegiate golf, gets a bunch of exemptions that way, and just shoots right up the PGA Tour U Accelerator list. You can get it done that way too. But in an era where you and I talk on the show about they have that path, they have the collegiate pathway, they have the turning pro immediately, there's, you could go try to get your card through the DP World Tour and be one of the top 10 finishers. It's just an interesting time for young, you know, amateur players and just the decisions they're making. And there's just so many talented players that it's interesting to see the different pathways they choose to take to make it to professional.
Yes. And just if there's any more insight I can get on the golf tournament, I would say that two things come to mind. One, Isaiah Salinda, young player out of Stanford, who's got a bunch of talent. You were high on him coming out. So was Nitties, and I've obviously kept note of him. Good to see him have a big moment on 18 to just miss out on the playoff. But the other one was Aaron Rye, man. I was with him all day. And dude, just like, he should have won the golf tournament, man. Like, he should have won the tournament. He could have been 600 through seven holes. He was hitting it better than anybody, hits it a little longer than Campbell, obviously, but just as good with the precision iron game, and the putter and the chip, like his wedge play just like totally let him down, which I think he'd be a great Ryder Cup player because of how well he hits it. But his putting just always never looked good to my eye. Now I'm sure he's had great putting weeks in his career. Like, you can't be a top 30 player in the world like he is without being a pretty good putter, which he's most certainly, I wouldn't say like an elite putter by any means, it really let him down the stretch.
Yeah, but the bogeys at 16 and 17, you know, if he makes par, I know 16 was playing as one of the hardest holes on the course today.
Hit the fairway though, left it in a bad spot.
You're in the playoff. And I, if I'm Aaron Rye and I have a tour win under my belt, I love my chances amongst that trio in terms of who's going to win the golf tournament. But yeah, man, that guy loves a driver out the deck, doesn't he? Nobody's loved a driver out the deck.
He had two drivers in the bag this week.
So what was he? I assume one was a mini driver.
No.
Or is it, there were just two legit drivers?
He had two drivers. He went from driver, hybrid. No, driver, 21 degree.
And both full size heads.
Yeah.
I heard you say this on the broadcast, and I was like, surely he means like a mini driver. No, there were just two drivers.
Yeah.
Gotta love it, dude. That's some seriously sicko gear.
It's really good
stuff.
Off the ground. That's what they said. So
it sure does. By the look of it,
he actually had tweeners into par fours today, and some par fives with the hybrid. Like, the hybrid was like, he had to stretch it, and then like, he can't hit a drive. Like, his next club's a driver. So like, so he was kind of hands tied behind his back a little bit.
Can you imagine bunting a driver off the deck into a par four? It just like, what? I don't even know how to wrap my head around that play at all.
Oh my gosh.
That's great stuff. Well, I think that's about all we have on Mexico Open, unless you want to get any other notes in, because there was another piece of news that occurred during the tournament this week on Thursday, the breaking news about negotiations happening between Yasir Al-Rumayyan, Donald Trump was involved, Jay Monahan, Tiger Woods, Adam Scott. We've continued to hear the drumbeat increasingly growing louder and louder that this whole deal could be revived and take a real shape. And that happened on Thursday. And so to break all that down, give us some more analysis and reporting, we have Gabby Herzig from The Athletic joining us. So let's get right to that conversation now and break down all the news coming on the PIF PGA Tour reunification front. Here's Gabby Herzig. Well, as promised, we are now joined by Gabby Herzig, a staff writer for The Athletic covering golf, to break down just another twist and turn in the ongoing saga that is the negotiations between the PGA Tour and the PIF. Feels like we're eons removed from the initial framework deal. But of course, this past week, Gabby, on Thursday, I believe it was February 20th, we had news trickling out about this meeting that happened between the Trump administration, Yasir Al-Rumayyan, Jay Monahan, Tiger Woods, and Adam Scott. So lots to unpack here, Gabby, but let's just start with the news of what that day was to update people who might have missed it.
Yeah, totally. So I think the first rumblings that we heard were actually from that Twitter account that tracks planes.
Love that.
Radar Atlas or whatever his name is. Does a great job, by the way. Shout out to that guy.
The best.
And we knew that like the PGA Tour plane had flown into DC, I think Tiger's plane too. So there was clearly something happening. And then in the morning, kind of reports start to come out and I'm, you know, checking with my sources about what's going on, what's happening. And it turns out that the second White House meeting between the PGA Tour, President Trump, and Yasir, who was actually there in person this time, was happening. And we had known that the meeting was coming up because Tiger said it on the CBS broadcast the week before at the Genesis and had hinted that there was going to be another meeting, but it wasn't really clear when that was going to be and how quickly the second one would actually happen. So quick turnaround there for them to get some more time on the president's calendar. Obviously, he's got a lot going on besides the professional golf landscape. So I'm actually like, it was pretty significant that they had 4 hours of his time on Thursday, especially with Yasir in person in the White House, which I was personally struck by that detail. And that's kind of basically what we know. They put out a very blanket statement about the results of the meeting, basically saying they initiated talks about reunification and had an interesting working session, basically word salad. And so there's not much we really know about what came out of that meeting other than that there's forward progress.
Well, Gabby, like you said, it was a big nothing burger that came out from the PGA Tour. We've seen these statements that they put out where we read, and we're like, okay, that's nothing. And it was another situation of that. And I felt like the PGA Tour, with all of the buzz, probably felt inclined they had to put a statement out because of, you know, I'm in the booth on Thursday, and there was a potential for us to go live to all of this to announce the new PGA Tour with Liv.
There was
some serious buzz behind the scenes that there was something happening and that it was imminent. So did it ever feel that way to you heading into these meetings that there was going to be some form of deal struck between the two parties?
Honestly, not really. I felt like this was just going to be like another baby step in the right direction, to be completely honest with you guys. From what I have been reporting on, like from the beginning of this, was first of all, before Trump was elected, the Department of Justice was investigating this deal. And the way that this would all work from an antitrust perspective is that you would have to have two separate tours remaining in order for those like red flags to not be raised from an investigation standpoint. Like the DOJ would bring a case against the PGA Tour and PIF if that deal went through and they basically created a monopoly of golf. Like that's exactly what they were trying to prevent from happening. But now that Trump is in office, it seems like from reading the tea leaves here that's not a problem anymore. And the idea of reunification and creating one tour is not something that they have to be squirmish about. I feel like we heard like that one tour language from Jay Monahan when he spoke to media at the Farmers, or no, sorry, the Genesis at Torrey. He had like a scrum with reporters, and for the first time in a really long time, mentioned the idea of players playing on one tour again. And I think that the reason that that language hasn't been used in so long is because of the Department of Justice. It wouldn't have been possible with that hurdle in the way to create one tour. So now all of a sudden you're seeing the language of reunification and these meetings with President Trump. And I feel like the holding block now is just figuring out how to satisfy all parties involved in creating that one tour reunification model, because that was what divided everyone in the first place. It was, do we want team golf? Do we want a global schedule? Like, there are so many things that they're probably needing to just hash out right now.
I want to, Gabby, parse out the sort of truth and fiction of the days. We saw a lot of different reports and rumors on Twitter, or X, I should say, you know, related to what the outcome of this thing would be and how soon we could see these players together. But before we get to that, it's very interesting talking about this one tour idea, because I think we all have heard various iterations of what this thing could look like reunified, and maybe not forcing you to put on your reporter hat and give us facts here, but just an opinionist sort of, you know, role here. What do you think it looks like? Because I think like the last iteration we heard was maybe the top X amount of live guys get exemptions into these signature events. We've already seen pathways created by various, you know, governing bodies of majors to, you know, the US Open, the Open Championship. What, in your opinion, do you think this looks like if it is a one unified tour?
Yeah, I've been trying to think about it, honestly, and it's really hard to conceptualize because there are so many different interests involved. I think the one thing that I'm struggling to figure out is like the team golf idea was, you know, Yasser's baby. Like, he's been promising live guys, you know, behind the scenes that team golf won't go away. And you know, there, I've been hearing rumblings of the fact that they might not want to accept a deal of reunification that doesn't involve team golf. So in my mind, I have no idea how that would work. Like, I can't see a way that, you know, the Tiger, Rory, you know, Cantlays of the world, like, agree to playing team golf all year round. I do think they're like, I can see a world in which golf becomes like this F1 Champions League type model. Like, Rory has been preaching that for a while now, the idea of like a global tour in some sense, where there are these big global events, like maybe Adelaide becomes one of them. And then maybe it's like the Irish Open or the Italian Open. And then the four majors on top of like 6, 7, 8, like global huge events with all the best players. That's kind of what makes the most sense in my mind. I just have no idea how like team golf will survive that model.
I mean, that's completely abandoning what the PGA Tour has been since, you know, we've all watched it, right? It's stroke play, 72 holes. And in all of this, I keep thinking about the two sides and how they're going to come together. I personally sense pride in this team golf concept and spending close to reported $5 billion into this. So there's a sense of, hey, like, are we really just going to throw away everything that we think exactly we've built, or at least that you preach that you've been built? And then on the other side of the coin, you get the PGA Tour, who they've been stubborn a lot of this episode of this entire process, where they maybe have been too narrow-minded. And now it seems like to me that LIV is saying, all right, we might do some team golf. The PGA Tour is like, okay, I don't know how team golf is going to work on tour, but we can figure it out. But in the same breath, I still feel like the PGA Tour wants to somehow dissolve the LIV Golf Tour. I don't think they want it. And if it was, to me, it feels like it would be under a PGA Tour umbrella. Like, it would have PGA Tour branding on it. That's where I feel like we're at now. I don't feel like, and obviously I wasn't in the meeting, Gabby, and mm-hmm. neither any of us here, but that's the part I just can't get past right now is just what you're talking about, the global tour, the two sides. I'm not sure if there's really necessarily an answer to that, but do you have any more context that you can maybe add to any of this?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I just feel like the central question right now in all of this is what happens to LIV Golf. And I wonder if the president's involvement and his interests in warming his relations with Saudi Arabia is going to play like a huge factor in like whether LIV Golf survives or not.
He technically said he didn't like it.
Yeah, he said he didn't like it. That's what Rory said, right?
Yeah, like, are we trusting Rory on this? I don't know.
It's a great call. Great call. He probably said that for a reason. I mean, he's very strategic with what he puts out there. So you never know. Like, it's a total question mark right now.
So we saw all sorts of things on Twitter on Thursday, of course. And I'm going to lead you with one that I think we've now debunked as fiction. But I also want to give you the floor so you can debunk anything else people saw out there and make sure that we're all on the same page. So the thing I saw was that there was a chance that the LIV and PGA Tour could be reunified as soon as the Players' Championship. And we could see LIV players in the Players, which you could just go look at a LIV schedule and say that's obviously not going to work for a lot of reasons. So I think it's safe to say that one's out of the question. Are there other things you saw out there where you're like, in the sourcing you had, that's not going to be a truth?
Yeah, that was the main one where I was just kind of confused. Like, I'm, you know, obviously the schedules don't line up. And then on top of that, like, from everything I've been hearing, LIV players have gotten no indication about what their status is in any of this. So I'm just curious, like, what that person who started that thought had heard and who they heard it from, because clearly there are rumors flying around, because, you know, I think everyone's just anxious and wants to get this thing done. But I think the biggest thing for me that was like, that is maybe misunderstood, is that difference in strategy now that Trump is in office with, you know, protecting preventing the Department of Justice from trying to block the deal by like maintaining the separation between two tours. And now like them being across that hurdle and hump in all of this. And it's kind of like I hate to be a pessimist here, but that like, almost as if they're starting from ground zero, because this just wasn't a possibility for so long. And it's like, were they even prepared for this not to be a possibility? Like, it seems like there was a new optimism in the hope of creating one tour. And now it's like, oh wait, how do we actually do that? And is anyone going to agree on how to do that?
And Gabby, one of the things that you've said here at the beginning of this was the thing that struck you the most was Yasser being in the White House. I guess just what about that to you is significant for someone that, you know, I would say I follow the golf, Gabby, and I somewhat follow the politics of things. But just can you talk a little bit about the significance of Yasser being in the White House in these meetings?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, for some context, I find like the intersection between sports and politics so fascinating. I was a politics major in college, so this part of like I totally am nerding out about. But like, President Trump's relationship and attitude towards the Saudis is extremely different from past administrations. Like, the Saudi Arabia was called the pariah by, I think, I don't want to misquote him, but I'm pretty sure Biden said that along the lines of that at some point, because of their human rights offenses and history with, you know, with the United States. So it's striking to see how close now a major player in the Saudi Arabian, you know, ecosystem and government is sitting in the White House, you know, speaking with the president and the commissioner of the PGA Tour. There was a lot that happened last week as well, like around the world, with Saudi being involved in the talks with Ukraine and the deal to end the war over there. And there was a summit in Miami that Trump attended, the FII Institute summit. There's a lot going on right now that, you know, Trump might have ulterior motives, foreign policy motives, and we're sitting around talking about like what the future of the PGA Tour is going to look like. So there's just so much happening here that I don't really think people fully understand like the implications of what he's doing.
Yeah, well, and Gabby, just to kind of get back on the team aspect for a second, because in trying to fold this whole thing together, you know, we're trying to make sense of how this stays around. We throw a lot of stuff at the wall here on the show and try to see what sticks. We've been trying to move the Zurich Classic to the fall for some time. So it's tune up for, nice, you know, Ryder Cup, President's Cup. That's one of our initiatives. But another, it would seem fairly obvious. We now have a PGA Tour sanctioned league that has 6 four-player teams. Like, if you wanted to fold this thing back together and you wanted to still play team golf, you know, now whether that happens on a green grass golf course or in a, you know, the SoFi Center, that I guess could be up for debate. But is that not, I mean, have you heard any reports at all about that being a possibility for folding these two leagues together, of just making that team component, you know, all mashed into one concept, whether that's TGL or that's on the course?
I haven't heard anything official, and I know just as much as you guys on this, but I was talking to one LIV caddy about, like, ideas that have been thrown around about how to bring this thing back together. And there was one that I thought was interesting enough to share here, is that maybe creating, like, geographically based four-man teams and, you know, having, like, the Australian team, the South African team, and then in the United States, maybe do like the East Coast team, West Coast, South, you know, whatever it might be. And maybe have those teams like have their own home tournaments. And then people, you know, each team travels and they get to like set up the course, like the Ryder Cup teams get to set up the course. And like, I can see that being cool. I just have no idea how it would work logistically.
Well, I think what comes in my head is there an appetite for this?
Yeah.
You know, I think you're either on one side or the other. It seems like, it feels like the general golf fan and viewer has picked a side in this. And I feel like very few are, or at least maybe this is just because I follow too much on X and it's so one side or the other. But that would be my biggest concern if I was the PGA Tour in this, is if you make the concessions with the LIV Golf Tour and say, okay, let's figure this out. We got a great plan together. We're going to partner up and we're going to have 6 to 8 team golf events. Now, this is the two things that I think of in this, is that first off, this is going to take away playing opportunities for some players. That's first and foremost as a player that comes in my mind. And then the second part is, is it actually going to make a difference as far as ratings go? Like, or do people really buy into this regional country, whatever rivalry we're trying to think? And that's like the big gamble I think you're taking, is that you might be losing some of your core audience.
Yeah. I mean, the PGA Tour has been emphasizing so much that they're doing everything for the fan, you know, the fan forward initiative with polling everyone on what they want and, you know, conducting study group or focus groups and all sorts of stuff. And they've been preaching this so much that you would think that that is going to be the number one goal going forward. But then again, if you have this like super powerful force, you know, wanting, requesting things and having its own interests in mind, how do you balance the two?
Yeah. Well, and then just to kind of play this forward a little bit, Gabby, and then you've been great with your time. We're going to let you go and head on to the back end of this episode, getting ready for a week down in South Florida. But just what do we look out for next as golf fans? Like, are there other meetings that are reported that are on the dockets? I mean, obviously, you mentioned the quick succession between meeting one and meeting two. Is there anything via your sourcing where this is what we should be prepared for next, and these are real timelines that we have factual information behind?
I honestly think it's so up in the air right now. That's my genuine assessment of this. The fact that they called it a working session doesn't indicate to me that we're close at all. Obviously, I know they want to get there, but I just feel like there are a lot of new factors at play that maybe haven't been thought about for like a year plus.
Well, my last question, Gabby, this is kind of about just general chit-chat that you may have heard, because I think the PGA Tour players, they have a voice for the most part when they want to speak upon issues that they think are right or wrong when it comes to the game, especially when it comes to the PGA Tour. LIV Golf players, you kind of get some chatter from them, but it's not as much about the reunification. It's kind of about the majors or you know, official World Golf ranking points. I'm curious, as like someone who probably has, you know, connections both places, has there been a bunch of chit chat from the LIV golfers on reunification from you, or are they just as much in the dark as we are?
I think it's like a giant waiting game. That's genuinely my assessment, is like, everyone's just like, when are we going to hear, you know, what are they going to tell us? But like chugging along with the LIV model, obviously, like they just signed a Fox deal. LIV Adelaide is renewed until 2031. Like, there's clearly a trajectory for LIV laid out for them right now. So I feel like from my perspective, like, people are just going with the flow.
I mean, when I heard the Scott O'Neill, the new LIV Golf CEO, say, yes, hey, if you want to watch the the best players in the world come right here. Sell. And I was just like, what? Yeah. Scott,
they're coming in hot. Yeah, they have a mission and a goal, and they're going to try to achieve it. So,
Gabby, it's an additive product to the game of golf. And that's what we as golf consumers need to remember. It's additive.
It's all additive, of course. That's exactly how this played out.
Scott knew something. He was ready for reunification. He was saying, you know, you'll see it live and extended live, but it's all kind of falls into the same umbrella. But I mean, I'd say that regardless, we're not too far from where we started this whole thing, you know, per this report, Gabby, and we just hope we get some more finite details and progress here. But really appreciate you taking the time, Gabby. Gabby Herzig of The Athletic, worth the price of subscription alone. And I just gotta know, are we gonna text Carl Paulson ahead of Augusta, see if we can't get a rematch in Palmetto?
I think it's already happening. That's what I'm hearing.
Oh, and I've been left out of the messages.
Oh no,
that's what happens. That's a tough scene.
We gotta figure this out. This Paul, is Paul, if you're if you're listening. Carl, if this you're is listening, live too. We're going to need to work on that.
My boy just got sniped, man.
Breaking news, I'm not playing Palmetto this year on my Augusta trip. That's the worst news I've had all day.
Did I replace Charlie? Like,
I think you did.
I don't know.
Yeah. Wow. Tough scene for me. I have nothing left to say. I'm heartbroken.
Oh, no. I shouldn't have said anything.
Thanks so much, Gabby.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thanks, Gabby.
Thanks again to Gabby Herzig for taking the time to join us and break all that down. I still don't understand what progress, if any, was made this week, but the fact that there's some general optimism about it, I guess, is something. But I guess we'll check in another few weeks or months to see if they're actually playing together. Let's move on to a few TGL news and notes, Smiley. And I say this because we have a big trip ahead of us this week. We're both going to be down in the Palm Beach area, and we are going to be at our first TGL match together in person, a rivalry match, Bay Golf Club, Jupiter Links Golf Club. The Jupe boys, I think, are right on the playoff cutoff line right now. I'm just wondering how you're feeling about your squad as we go to the home stretch of the TGL season.
Listen, we were never going to be the number one seed. I knew that going into the season. This was all about, can you just wrap your head around, your minds around these four guys coming together and finding a way to make the playoffs and then just be the Cinderella story.
That's, you know, I'm really happy for you. My team, of course, has just become the juggernaut. Can't lose, won't lose in overtime, won't lose in regulation, has all the right pieces. So, I mean, I'm going to feel bad, you know, just watching your Cinderella team try to get it done against my Bay Boys this week. But, you know, you never know. Might have an upset out of the blue. Excited to find out. I will say you tried to trade away one of your players this week to Jordan Spieth as he the expansion franchise for the Texas Wedges. I didn't even know this was a thing. I thought that the whole news that Tony Finau signed a one-day contract to play for LAGC. I mean, that was – I thought the first thing that was going to happen on that front was going to be a replacement for Xander with the injury for New York Golf Club. But Tony Finau in there for LAGC. We might see a Smiley Kaufman cameo at some point.
I don't know if the people want to see that. But I did like the name, the Texas Wedges. The other ones I saw in the comments that I thought were good were the Texas Toast. That was great. The Bayou Bandits, if Sam Burns and I want to get a team together, would be great. That's another opportunity to get a NOLA style team together, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it'd be cool to see different arenas pop up around the country with this whole thing. But I'm excited to see it in person, man. I'm not expecting to like it as much. I think I'll be excited about seeing just the stage of what it is. But I think not being able to hear the audio will take away from just the whole experience, because I think that is something they probably need to figure out to improve the, you know, I guess up around the green, you can kind of tell what's going on, but you still can't hear them. You got to find a way for the people in the stands to feel like they're just as immersed in the action as the folks watching from their couch.
I'm similarly intrigued to see what the in arena experience is. I mean, I was there for media day, but they were playing a match, obviously. And then there was an on-course demonstration where we were just walking. So we were there. You could hear everything. But it is going to be very intriguing to see what that's like in the arena on the night of. But I do think it's just seeing the tech up close. I think, you know, fingers crossed we get good tickets. We get to hear these guys bantering in and around the bench. I think it'll be a fun time.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see. And then, you know, maybe it's just, let's just hope that your Jute boys stay in it. Or we get like an overtime match again. I'd love to see Kiz chip cross-handed. That'd be very nice.
Yeah, I'm excited. I got my Jupe Links t-shirt I'm going to wear.
You bring the tee? Do you have any other Jupe gear with you? Because I've got so much Bay gear, it's obscene.
No, I'm just going to wear my Jupe Links t-shirt. Just support my boys.
We'll see if we can't drum up some more Jupe stuff for you but by the time we get down to South Florida. But yeah, look forward to that. We're excited for this week. We have, of course, you're listening to this recap episode now from the Mexico Open. And then Wednesday's episode should be our full recap from the Jupe Bay match. And then rolling right into Cognizant, where there are some big names in the field this week, including Jordan Spieth. So excited for that. Appreciate y'all taking the time to watch and listen. And stay tuned this week for more TGL content from Palm Beach. We'll talk to you very soon.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people on YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the...